Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 5th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call and our discussion of Yates versus U.S., a statutory interpretation decision reached recently concerning fish, tangible objects, and Sarbanes-Oxley. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Very pleased to welcome back to our call to Teleform Todd F. Bronstein. He is counsel at the Wilmer Hale Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. He attended oral argument, did a preview of this case, an oral argument assessment, and is now read the decision. And is prepared to give us opening remarks and his thoughts, first outlining some background on the case, and then discussing some of the possible implications of the decision. He's going to speak in opening remarks 10, 15, or 20 minutes or so. But as always, we'll be looking for questions from the audience, so do be ready with those when we get to that portion of the program. And with that, Todd Bronstein, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean. So Yates versus United States drew national attention because of its absurd fact pattern. An obstruction of justice statute was passed as part of Sarbanes-Oxley was used to convict a man who had quite literally destroyed some fish. And as silly as that sounds, the legal issues raised by the case were never nearly so straightforward. And that was very much in evidence last week as the Supreme Court issued a decision in the case that was closely divided. The court did reverse Yates' conviction, but only by a vote of 5-4, and the fifth and deciding justice wrote that he considered the case a close one. And somewhat surprisingly, to those who witnessed the heated oral argument in this case, the considerations of over-criminalization that this case has come to symbolize were barely a factor in the opinions. In fact, a majority of the justices didn't view the sweeping nature of the interpretation urged by the government as a reason for voting as they did. So first, some background about the case. Mr. Yates was a commercial fisherman who was captain of Miss Katy, a vessel that harvested fish in the Gulf of Mexico. On August 23, 2007, there was a routine inspection by a deputized federal officer of the ship. The officer noticed several red grouper that appeared to be smaller than what was required under federal fishing regulations. Measured the fish and determined that Yates had illegally harvested 72 undersized red grouper. The officer put the fish in wooden crates and told Yates to leave them there and bring them back to port for investigation by the National Marine Fisheries Service. But Mr. Yates told one of his crew members to throw the fish overboard and replace them with larger fish. Later, under questioning, the crew member told the truth and implicated Yates. And Yates was prosecuted for several obstruction of justice crimes. One of the laws he was charged under was the Sarbanes-Oxley provision, which is known as Section 1519. And that crime penalizes any effort to destroy or tamper with, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, unquote, as long as there was intent to obstruct a pending or contemplated federal inquiry. So in this case, the government argued that the tangible object was the red grouper. And Mr. Yates was convicted, appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that red grouper fell outside the statute. In the opinion last week, the court reversed Yates' conviction over a spirited dissent by four justices. The lineup was certainly unconventional. Justice Ginsburg wrote the plurality opinion, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Breyer, and Justice Sotomayor. The fifth and decisive vote was Justice Alito, who, of course, is ordinarily among the most pro-government justices in criminal cases. He did not join the majority opinion, but wrote separately to express his views. On the other side, Justice Kagan's dissent was joined by Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas in support of the government. So Justice Ginsburg's opinion for the plurality began by acknowledging the obvious, that a fish, a red grouper, is a, quote, tangible object, under the literal meaning of that phrase. So while a word's usage in a statute will ordinarily accord with its dictionary definition, the same word used in different contexts may sometimes mean different things. And in this case, Section 1519 was passed as part of Sarbanes-Oxley. That law, which Congress approved in the wake of the Enron accounting scandals, focused on corporate fraud. Given this context, a tangible object under Section 1519 had to be an object used to preserve or record information, and it did not refer to all objects in the physical world, or so Justice Ginsburg and the court held. Justice Ginsburg acknowledged that the dictionary definitions of the word tangible and object were important considerations, but not dispositive. And she pointed to several other interpretive guides that she said pointed in a narrowing direction. First, the title of Section 1519 addresses tampering with records rather than with all tangible objects. Second, Congress chose to codify Section 1519 alongside other crimes that prohibit obstructive acts in very narrow and specific contexts. According to Justice Ginsburg, this was an unnatural place to locate a generalized obstruction statute. Third, Justice Ginsburg invoked the canon against surplusage and pointed to the simultaneous enactment in Sarbanes-Oxley of another law, Section 1512C1. That's a law that prohibits destruction of, quote, any record, document, or other object, albeit only in connection with an official proceeding. Both Mr. Yates and the government had accepted that other object in this statute, in fact, covered every physical object. And Justice Ginsburg said that 1512C1 would serve no independent purpose if 1519 covered each and every physical object. Fourth, Justice Ginsburg emphasized twin canons of construction with Latin names that I am not going to even pretend I know how to pronounce. One canon is that a word is known by the company it keeps, and the other is that a general word at the end of a statutory enumeration takes on the character of more specific words or precedents. Here, under those two canons, a tangible object should be construed to mean something like a record or document, rather than anything under the sun. Towards the end of her opinion, Justice Ginsburg did invoke the concerns about over-criminalization that this case has come to symbolize, but she did so almost as an alternative argument. She emphasized the sweeping breadth of the government's reading, the 20-year maximum for destroying any physical object that might have evidentiary value in any federal investigation, civil or criminal, pending or contemplated. And she said that under the rule of lenity, the court would need to require a clearer statement before adopting broader reading of tangible object. But she emphasized that this argument about the rule of lenity was only, the way I took it was she didn't feel it was necessary for the decision, that she didn't view the statute as ambiguous. The rule of lenity is only a tiebreaker, and she didn't view it as necessary, but she included it as a fallback. Justice Alito, as mentioned earlier, wrote a short opinion concurring in the judgment. He stated at the outset of his opinion that he found the question close, but ultimately thought Gates had the better argument. Justice Alito's opinion focused entirely on the text of Section 1519, including basically just a close reading of the section heading and the nouns and the verbs of that section. Notably, he did not invoke broader purposes of Sarbanes-Oxley, or the sweeping nature of the government's construction, or any of the other over-criminalization arguments that were emphasized by Niki and that were mentioned in the plurality. For that reason, I think it's fair to conclude that a majority of the justices were ultimately not persuaded that the statute's enactment as part of Sarbanes-Oxley or the sweeping breadth of the government's construction should be factors in the outcome. Justice Kagan wrote the dissent. She emphasized that in using the term tangible object, Congress said what it meant and meant what it said. She pointed to a number of other federal and state statutes that use this phrase or the phrase tangible thing, and all of them have been interpreted in line with the dictionary definition of tangible object or tangible thing. Justice Kagan agreed that context is important to interpreting a statute, but thought that it actually cut in the government's direction here. She did point to Section 1512C1, the other obstruction statute that was passed in Sarbanes-Oxley, but thought that it supported the government's interpretation and not Yates's. She wondered how the majority could decide that the very same Sarbanes-Oxley could define other object as everything under the sun and tangible objects as only information recording devices. Justice Kagan also pointed to legislative history indicating that Congress wanted a broad law. She thought that those Latin canons of construction also supported the government because record and documents could refer more broadly to a thing that provides information, and therefore tangible objects could have a broad definition as well. Towards the end of her opinion, Justice Kagan addressed the majority's comments about statutory breadth. She argued that they were slightly exaggerated with the statute, but acknowledged that Section 1519 is a bad statute, in her words. Too broad and undifferentiated, and had a statutory maximum that was too high. And she then took it a step further and said that Section 1519 was not an outlier, but, quote, an emblem of a deeper pathology in the federal criminal code, unquote. But, she said, it was up to Congress and not the courts to decide questions about statutory breadth. And thus, five of the nine justices didn't view the larger debate about statutory breadth or criminalization as relevant to their votes. Although Yates is an interesting case in its own right, any discussion of the opinion would be incomplete without mentioning King versus Burwell, the Obamacare case that was argued just yesterday. The King case has some similarities to Yates in that the debate in both is over how much weight one should give the literal meaning of the key phrase at issue. My thought on this and how Yates might apply is that Chief Justice Roberts is widely considered one of the swing votes in King, and his agreement with the majority in Yates is probably not a good omen for the Obamacare challengers. In Yates, Chief Justice Roberts was willing to sign on to an opinion that emphasized the broader goals of the statute and other factors as a way to overcome the literal meaning of the phrase at issue. He wasn't persuaded by Justice Kagan's argument that Congress said what it meant what it said. And there are surely ways, of course, to distinguish King and Yates. And indeed, based on the oral argument in King, it seems like Justice Kagan, for one, is prepared to do exactly that. Nevertheless, it isn't a good sign that Chief Justice Roberts signed on to a broader, more purposeless opinion, and it may be the signal of what is to come in King versus Burwell. With that, that's Yates versus United States, and that concludes my opening remarks.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for that background and the discussion of the decision. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Todd Braunstein, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who might ring in here, let me make a quick commercial announcement. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, our topic for Teleform is going to be cybersecurity and the new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Author Shane Harris, he's a senior correspondent at the Daily Beast, will be joined by Paul Rosenzweig to discuss the book and some of the topics it brings up. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. And previewing next week, we'll recap this week's oral argument in Ohio versus Clark. And we'll have an update on the latest steps taken by the CFPB, and we'll be discussing some limitations on speech. But check our website for details for those upcoming conference calls. Today, of course, Todd Braunstein talking about Yates, the Sarbanes-Oxley tangible object fish case. We've got three callers with questions. If you want to join that queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. But for today, let's take our first call.
Yes, sir. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm a Federalist Society member. I was noticing in the oral arguments that Justice Scalia seemed particularly concerned about that cases of a trivial nature would be tried or could be tried under 1519 of the Sarbanes-Oxley, which is a felony statute carrying a possible 20-year sentence, and that the absurdity of charging a fisherman with throwing, a few fish away, the absurdity might be lost to the thought processes of, say, a certain judge, and there you have it. You've got one fish that's 1 inch too small, and you got a guy that could be sentenced to 20 years. And if you consider that in the context of the possibility that they could have ruled that tangible object really meant any physical object, that you know, that we, the American people, have dodged you know, quite a big bullet. I'd kind of like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you're absolutely right that you know, Justice Scalia most forcefully, but other justices too, during the oral argument, were very concerned about this prosecution, to the point where Justice Scalia said, you know, if this is the interpretation you're going to be urging and this is the type of prosecutions you're going to be bringing, I'm going to have to reconsider how much breadth I give these statutes in my decision.
Right.
Ultimately, though, Justice Scalia, I did side with Justice Kagan, and in holding that exactly the statutory breadth the government wanted was what was appropriate. And I think what Justice Kagan said, that this is a decision for Congress, is very much in line with Justice Scalia's overall jurisprudence. You know, I think all nine justices would probably agree that this was a pretty silly prosecution, that that shouldn't have been brought. Ultimately, that's a decision for the Justice Department and for Congress. In her dissent, Justice Kagan did talk a little bit about the breadth of this statute, and she did say there were some mitigating factors here that would not make this as concerning as one might think. Obviously, 20-year sentence is extremely unlikely for facts like this.
Right, and I was just being hypothetical.
Right. And in this case, Yates was sentenced to 30 days, and that's most federal judges, I dare say almost all of them, would have come down similarly.
We hope so.
We hope so. But certainly this was an incredibly broad statute, mm-hmm. and the attention that this case got no doubt contributes to the broader over-criminalization effort that is taking hold and is gaining traction in Congress. And ultimately, Congress is where these issues have to be hashed out, Congress and the DOJ.
Right. Thank you.
We got two questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Sort of, before we go to our next audience member, let me follow up on that question. You mentioned in her dissent, joined by three other justices, that Justice Kagan cited this sort of language as an emblem rather than an outlier in terms of the way Congress passes criminal statutes. Is she issuing an invitation to litigation there, or is this just what do you make of that statement, especially combined with Scalia's sentiments at oral argument that if this is the way Congress is going to draft things, the courts are going to have to, including the Supreme Court, are going to have to sort of take a different view, maybe a more dim view or narrow some of this language. Is the court signaling there, or the dissenters at least? How do you read
it? I thought that that Justice Kagan in saying that was basically saying, you know, these are questions of policy that we think is bad policy, but actually I think on the contrary, kind of powerless to, or not powerless, we don't think it's our role to sort of step in and narrow it. I actually thought that the opinion in that regard was deviated somewhat from what Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy had said at oral argument, where they did suggest that they wanted to, that they thought it would be, they suggested it would be appropriate for them to offer narrowing instructions in these circumstances. But I actually thought that what Justice Kagan was saying was that the appropriate forum for this is Congress, not us.
Interesting. And let me ask just one other question, and this sort of ties into King versus Burwell. What's the distinction in this case versus King versus Burwell? How does the fact that this is a criminal statute cut with regard to the different justices? What difference does that make in your mind?
Well, I think that the rule of lenity was invoked by the majority, and that may be something that is cited by Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Breyer obviously they invoked the rule of lenity as part of their majority opinion, and at the same time, they are going to be arguing, based on oral arguments yesterday, that the plain language of Duquesne versus Burwell doesn't really mean what it says there either, that broader considerations will overcome the plain language. The rule of lenity might be something that Chief Justice Roberts uses to distinguish this case from King versus Burwell, to say that if it's a criminal case, it's appropriate for us to be cautious in how we construe it, whereas King versus Burwell, you're not talking about a criminal statute, you're just talking about subsidies. So in that case, you're more willing to give more weight to a broader reading and less demanding of a clear statement. So that could be a way that Chief Justice Roberts justifies a differing vote in the two. I guess that would be what I would say about it.
All right. Two questions pending. Again, push the star button and the pound button if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's check back in with our audience now.
Yes, Todd, it's David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. Thanks for your comments on this case. My question has something to do with probably what wasn't actually argued before the court, or perhaps in the briefs. But this is a curious case, and if you have some kind of background information that you can share with us on how it is that, you know, given the other violations which were apparent on the surface here, destruction of evidence, obstruction of justice, and how is it that this ended up in a Sarbanes-Oxley litigation? And I think you had remarked earlier about perhaps this was a silly case to have been brought. But at some point, the Supreme Court exercised its discretion in granting cert on this case. And if you have any thoughts on how or your reading of the tea leaves and why they thought that this was a case that deserved their attention, I'd appreciate your sharing that as well.
Sure. I'll take the second question first. I think that the Supreme Court, sort of the conventional wisdom is that the Supreme Court takes criminal cases when they want to find for the defendant, and they reverse the government more often than not. And I think it's probably what happens here is there was no circuit split. The circuits were unanimous in construing tangible objects in line with its dictionary definition. And my guess is that the court looked at this fact pattern and thought it was crazy and thought that it had gone too far, the DOJ had gone too far in interpreting tangible objects as broadly as it had, and that they needed to rein it in. I think it is precisely just that. It was not about a circuit split or a question of great national import, but sometimes these types of fact patterns may capture the court's imagination. In fact, they did reverse it ultimately, probably suggested that was motivating to take cert in the first place. Your second question about how it is that this came to be charged under Sarbanes-Oxley. Yates was actually charged with three different crimes. A false statements crime, a sort of general destruction of evidence that government is trying to take, and then this. He was convicted on two of the three counts. He was convicted on the Sarbanes-Oxley count and on the destruction of evidence that the government is trying to seize counts. And in his appeal to the Supreme Court, only one of his two convictions was at issue. So even though the government, the court reversed his conviction on Sarbanes-Oxley, that doesn't change the fact that he's a convicted felon. He's already served his 30 days. So it's not going to change that, and it wouldn't change that. In a sense, this appeal, I thought all along was really just more symbolic than anything else, because it doesn't have very significant practical ramifications for Mr. Yates, who is still convicted of felons at this day.
We've got just one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, this is John Badalamenti. I'm a Federal Society member in Tampa and council record for Mr. Yates. How is everyone doing? I think you've done a great job, Mr. Bronstein, talking about the facts of the case and the holding of this complicated division of justices. In my petition, I did challenge both convictions, but the court only took the first issue, which was the application of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And I think the answer to why a prosecutor would go ahead and charge this from my brother out in Berkeley would probably be answered by Justice Roberts at oral argument, is that when you're dealing with a 20-year statutory maximum, it provides great leverage for a prosecutor to get someone to plead. I suppose my question would be, were you surprised with Justice Scalia's joining in the alignment of the textualists in that particular dissent where legislative history was cited, and Justice Scalia didn't do a special, his own little opinion discussing the way he would not have considered that?
Yeah, I noticed that also. I thought it was curious, but I also noticed that Justice Kagan, when she introduced that part of her opinion, said something like, the legislative history
for those that matters.
For those who think it matters,
yeah,
also cuts in our direction, and that may have been a bone for Justice Scalia to avoid him writing separately or joining all but Part 3A or whatever it is. I was surprised by Justice Scalia's vote overall in this case. And were you the attorney who actually argued it?
Yes.
Okay, you did a very fine job, and you saw how upset Justice Scalia was by this, and he did seem to suggest he was going to be going the other way, but ultimately, of course, he did not.
And I agree. I agree with your comments. My biggest concern was in the hook of, sorry about the pun, but the idea of the cert petition was to say, listen, we don't look at, and this court does not permit, even under textual analysis, isolated meanings set forth in a dictionary and create a fortress out of the dictionary. But context does matter. Even in his book, in Justice Scalia's book, it talks about the importance of a contextual reading, where you're not relying on legislative history and things like that, but you're relying around the words that surround the undefined phrases in a particular statute. See, here we didn't have any definition of tangible object, whereas in Bond, he wrote his special concurrence based on the fact that he would not have agreed with Justice Roberts in his way of looking at the statute, because the chemical weapon was indeed defined there. See, in this case, we did not have a defined phrase. Congress was left silent, which makes context that's more important, because tangible object has multiple meanings depending on their context. So I was kind of surprised that he did not write about this, but simply joined.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question of context, the dissent, as you know, acknowledged that context who could disagree with the proposition that context is critical for interpreting the statute? I think Justice Kagan wrote, and they took a different view. I tend to agree that their arguments that record and document could mean something refer to something broader than just something that records information seemed a little bit strange to me, but they at least accepted the principle that context was important, and they just had a different view of it than the majority of the plurality did.
Let me make a final call for questions here. Our lines are still open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Todd, I don't see any lingering questions there. Do you want to take a minute or two to wrap up before we adjourn the call?
Sure. This was a very strange case with a strange fact pattern that turned out to be a fairly complicated question. It sort of sounds absurd on its face, and that's why it got the attention that it did. But the government really did have some strong arguments, and ultimately the case was about as close as you could get, with four justices thinking it was pretty strong one way, four justices being strong the other way, and the deciding vote, Justice Alito, saying that it was a close call. All nine justices engaged in very close, very careful textual analysis, and just came out in opposing ways and had their views.
Well, I certainly appreciate you making a repeat appearance here. I appreciate your earlier appearances, but I certainly appreciate you doing this today. I know you've had to plow your way through the snowstorm here in Washington, D.C. to join us even on the telephone. So thank you so much for your efforts. I also want to thank our audience for joining us today. It's good to hear from you all. Thank you for your questions as well. And a reminder to our audience about our next Teleforum conference call scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, with the author and another interviewer joining us. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.